From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Gary Snyder on beat poetry, Zen Buddhism, and American wilderness. Classic Gothic fiction uses gloomy, gruesome settings to frighten readers. Coming up, we meet writer Patrick McGraw. His new Gothic fiction is about psychological torment. And film critic Owen Gleiberman reviews Three Men and a Little Lady, the sequel to Three Men and a Baby. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. China and the Soviet Union have expressed deep concern about the Gulf situation. Soviet Foreign Minister Eduard Shevardnadze and his Chinese counterpart held talks in China today, but the BBC's James Miles reports the foreign ministers weren't clear about whether their countries would support a UN resolution endorsing the use of force against Iraq.
According to the official New China News Agency, the two foreign ministers demanded that Iraq withdraw its troops from Kuwait unconditionally and immediately, and repeated their calls for UN resolutions on the crisis to be carried out strictly. It said both sides stood for a political solution, and that as long as there was still hope for peace, the international community should work to that end and try its best to avoid war. China and the Soviet Union, it said, shouldered an important responsibility for safeguarding world peace. But the report didn't say whether the two men discussed how their countries would react to a UN resolution endorsing the use of force against Iraq. Both countries would have the right of veto over such a proposal, but the news agency failed to make it clear what their positions would be.
The BBC's James Miles. Thousands of Jordanians marched today to protest President Bush's visit to the Persian Gulf. More than 4,000 people joined the protest in the Jordanian capital of Amman. Some carried banners in support of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein and called for strikes against American interests in the region. Muslim preachers also condemned President Bush's visits with Egyptian and Saudi leaders in their Friday sermons at Jordanian mosques. There have been emotional scenes outside the Bulgarian parliament as the leader of an opposition party greeted 5,000 of his supporters who were demonstrating. Moments before, the opposition Union of Democratic Forces had announced its withdrawal from the parliament. From Sofia, Owen Bennett-Jones reports.
The opposition's decision to withdraw from parliament followed a vote of no confidence in the government. The Bulgarian government is made up of the Bulgarian Socialist Party, a reincarnation of the former Communist Party. Despite the fact that the socialists won the no-confidence vote, the opposition declared themselves unhappy at the fact that they themselves did not win and thereby get the chance to form their own government. As a result, they walked out of the parliament for an indefinite period. While the members of the parliament debated, thousands of opposition demonstrators gathered outside the parliament buildings and called for the resignation of the government. Prime Minister Andrei Lukanov has seen off the parliamentary challenge, but he now faces a different kind of opposition. Union leaders committed to bringing down the government have called for a general strike starting on Monday. For National Public Radio, I'm Owen Bennett-Jones in Sofia.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 12 points today to close at 2,527.23. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Allen Ginsberg has called my guest, poet Gary Snyder, an American literary cultural hero, ripened as wilderness philosopher activist, integrating ecological planet karma with Native American poetry's indigenous household view. Snyder became something of a countercultural hero in the 50s when Jack Kerouac used him as the model for the main character in his novel Dharma Bums. Snyder left San Francisco's beat poetry scene in 1956. His interest in Asian thought led him to the East, where he spent the next 12 years studying Buddhism in Japan and visiting temples in India. When he returned to the States, he settled in Northern California, became active in environmental issues, and continued to write poetry and essays about the natural world. His book Turtle Island won a Pulitzer Prize. His essays from the past 15 years are collected in the new book The Practice of the Wild. It's published by North Point Press, which also just brought out a new edition of his collection Rip Rap and Cold Mountain Poems. Snyder lives on the San Juan Ridge in Northern California. In his essays, he writes a lot about having a sense of place. I asked when a sense of place first became important to him.
Growing up as I did in the forested areas north of Seattle, I bonded, as you might say, to my original place very strongly, being out in it a lot and working on the farm around it a lot. And learning my way through the forest and through the swamps. I think that this is a very natural and normal thing to do. And all I've done, really, is expand the territory of the place that I really feel I can be at home in. I've moved the center from Puget Sound down here to the Sierra Nevada of California. But my larger sense of place, and I could tell you how I define that, covers the West Coast from Big Sur to Fairbanks, Alaska.
How close to the wilderness do you live?
Depends on what you mean by wilderness, but we have black bear, mountain lions, lots of deer, fox wandering right through our yard.
You asked me what I mean by wilderness, so let me ask you what you mean by the wild in the title of your book, The Practice of the Wild.
By the wild, I mean something a little different from wilderness. I mean, by the wild, I mean the essential processes of unmediated nature. And as processes, they're found on every level, from the microscopic to the cosmic, and consequently, the wild is permeates cities, permeates factories, and is really what our own bodies are, wild organisms. Wilderness would be those territories where the processes of the wild are maximized, but the wild is nothing endangered at all.
There's a reading I'd like you to do from The Practice of the Wild, your new collection of essays. This begins with a reference to Thoreau.
I'll read it for you. Thoreau says, "Give me a wildness no civilization can endure." That's clearly not difficult to find. It is harder to imagine a civilization that wildness can endure, yet this is just what we must try to do. Wildness is not just the preservation of the world, as Thoreau says, it is the world. Civilizations east and west have long been on a collision course with wild nature, and now the developed nations in particular have the witless power to destroy not only individual creatures, but whole species, whole processes of the earth. We need a civilization that can live fully and creatively together with wildness. We must start growing it right here in the new world.
In addition to your new book coming out, The Practice of the Wild, there's a book about you that's coming out soon. It's called Gary Snyder, Dimensions of a Life, and it's a lot of essays and short memoirs about you. And one person in it, Michael Mahar, says that your mother, when you were growing up with this guy, that your mother had canceled a weekend camping trip because you didn't get an A on a Latin quiz, so you had to stay home and do homework. and he says that the other kids' parents didn't stress school because the other kids weren't expected to grow up and go into jobs where formal education was required. Did your mother stress school a lot, and what were her expectations for what you were going to grow up and do?
My mother stressed learning, and she stressed literacy and reading a lot, and never said a word about careers or about expectations of success. She had a much broader humanistic sort of open position than some narrowly defined notion of what you should become or do, although at the time I didn't realize it.
Michael Mahar also said that you were so poor that you used to bring your own tea bags to coffee shops because you couldn't afford the price of the tea.
We all did that in college.
Uh-huh. Were you poor?
Oh, yeah. I grew up in the Depression and was doing a lot of work and supporting myself a lot from about 15 on.
What did your parents do?
My father was from an old Pacific Northwest working family. Who worked for the U.S. government during World War II after being unemployed for a number of years of the Depression. And in later years, stayed on and off working for the government and doing a lot of carpentry and cabinet building. My mother was wanted to be a writer and got in a couple of years at the University of Washington as a young woman and did some nice writing of poetry and short stories. But then the Depression cut all that short, and she found herself living out on a stump farm in the woods and was rather frustrated by that.
When you were in your 20s, I guess, and spending some time logging, was that mostly to be in nature or mostly to make a living?
Oh, that was a good way to make some money, and it was in line with the skills I had, because where I grew up, we handled those tools a lot. Our neighbors, my uncles, were all working either in the woods or at sea. And so with those skills, it wasn't difficult for me to pick up employment. And I switched back and forth between working as a seasonal laborer for the U.S. Forest Service sometimes or working in logging camps.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I think the big environmental issue this past summer out your way was deforestation, the cutting of original growth like the old redwoods.
Mm-hmm.
As a former logger yourself, where were you on that issue?
Well, I'm also very active in environmental issues, and I've been working on forestry issues for, that's been one of my main focuses last 10 years. Of course, I believe that it's quite possible to have a sustainable logging industry that could be carried on for thousands of years, but that requires much more careful management policies than the U.S. government is calling for on public land today, and infinitely more careful practices than is being carried on private land.
Gary Snyder is my guest, and he has a new collection of essays called The Practice of the Wild. You've written, I grew up with the poetry of 20th century coolness, its hard edges and resilient elitism. When it came to writing out of my own experience, most of modernism didn't fit. Why didn't modernism fit your experience?
It's a little hard to put an answer to that, except to say modernism is resolutely urban and cosmopolitan and has its spiritual centers in Paris, London, and New York. Nature was considered second class and marginal by the mentality of modernism. Whereas for someone like myself, out at the far edge of the New World, in an area that had only been settled for 40 years and had been a vast forest wilderness for all previous millennia, the experiences are not the same. The things, looking at mountain landscapes, working with wildlife, and also with the physical labor of tools and logging exploitation, the human problems of both Indians and white people around Puget Sound, there's no place in that in the poetry of T.S. Eliot or Wallace Stevens.
And you found what you were looking for more in Chinese and Japanese poems?
It gave me a push in a new direction. It's not as though that was a whole new model to follow by any means, but a Chinese civilization, for example, Chinese culture, opened up an angle to me of the possibility of a high civilization with all of that refinement and sophistication that we expect from a civilization that had a much less exploitative attitude toward the natural world. Now, to be honest, as it turns out in practice, by the time the 20th century rolls around, China and Japan are just as bad as anybody else.
You reprint some of your poems in The Practice of the Wild, and I'm going to ask you to read one of those poems for us, any one of your choosing.
This comes out of the world of the experience of a young white guy logging together with elder Indian working men loggers, Native American Indian loggers, with some of the cultural complexities of that. Ray Wells, a big Nisqually, and I, each set a choker on the butt logs of two big larch in a thorn apple thicket and a swamp. Waiting for the cat to come back, he said, yesterday we gelded some ponies. My father-in-law cut the skin on the balls. He's a Wasco and don't speak English. He grabs a handful of tubes and somehow cuts the right ones. The ball jumps out. The horse screams, but he's all tied up. The caterpillar clanked back down. In the shadow of that racket, diesel and iron tread, I thought of Ray Wells' teepee out on the sage flats, the gelded ponies healing and grazing in the dead white heat.
Were you ever considered odd for liking poetry when you were young?
Not in my immediate family. Actually, I must confess, no. I was never given any trouble for it anywhere. Not in logging camps and not working on ships.
But you expected to be, maybe? Did you ever, like, hide it initially from people?
I'll tell you what I hid when I was working on ships or in logging camps. I hid my educated vocabulary and educated tone of voice. I talked like a working man. That covers everything.
Was it natural for you to talk that way? I mean, which was your first tongue? Which was your native tongue? Talking like a working man or talking like an educated man?
I grew up with both. I would say about equally.
So you're bilingual.
Bilingual, right. Bidialectical.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is writer Gary Snyder, and he has a new collection of essays, and it's called The Practice of the Wild. This is Fresh Air. Essayist, naturalist, and environmentalist Gary Snyder is my guest. You moved to the Bay Area in, what, I think it was 1952?
And 52, yeah.
And it was in the Bay Area that you met Allen Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac. I'm wondering if you felt that you found kindred spirits when you met them.
Oh, indeed I did. There weren't many poets around that were working in the kind of idiom that I was trying for. And it was a great pleasure to run onto Allen and then to Jack Kerouac. Prior to that, my only other poetic comrades were Philip Whalen and Lew Welch.
Now, Ginsberg and Kerouac were both urban.
And but widely traveled and widely worked. Both of them had been to sea. Both of them had been to Mexico.
So that wasn't a gap for you, the difference between your...
We worked it out. I mean, I took them hiking, and they taught me some city smarts.
Like what?
Well, Jack taught me how to sit on the backside of Skid Row and drink Tokay out of a bottle in a brown paper sack.
A useful skill, huh?
Yeah. And how not to get noticed doing that.
Right. Well, that is very useful.
Yeah.
Now you were the main character in Kerouac's book Dharma Bums was based on you.
Yeah, so I'm told.
And well, I want to read you a short description here. He wore a little goatee, strangely oriental looking, with his somewhat slanted green eyes, but he didn't look like a bohemian at all, and was far from being a bohemian, a hanger-on around the arts. He was wiry, suntanned, vigorous, open, all howdies and glad talk, and even yelling hello to bums on the street. When asked a question, answered right off the bat from the top or bottom of his mind, I don't know which, and always in a sprightly, sparkling way. Sound like you?
Maybe not quite that cheery. Otherwise, okay.
there's a part in Dharma Bums where the character who I assume to be the Kerouac character, where the character based on you, Jeffrey Ryder, is talking to the character I assume to be based on Kerouac, and is talking to him about drinking too much and warning him about how it's really going to hurt him in the long run. Did you have conversations like that with Kerouac?
Oh, indeed I did. And it's part of the paradox of Jack's life that he could hear that conversation in real life, report it quite accurately in a novel, and then go ahead and keep drinking.
Right, right.
Yeah.
You left San Francisco after a few years and left the poetry scene there. Why did you move on?
Well, I had moved out I was in graduate school at Indiana University after I left Reed College for a year in linguistics. And I came out to the Bay Area to study Chinese and Japanese at Berkeley to prepare myself to go to the Far East. I had decided that I wanted to study Zen Buddhism. And so when the opportunities all came together, I set sail, literally right out of San Francisco, to go to Japan and study. And I left all that poetry scene behind.
Did you ever think of yourself as spending the rest of your life in a monastery? Was that a consideration at all, or was there something else that you wanted to get out of the experience?
A Zen monastery is not a monastery in the Catholic sense, a place where you commit yourself to live for a lifetime. A Zen monastery could be more reasonably described as a sort of seminary. It's a training school, and when you finished your training, you move on. Moving on means you re-enter the world and you do what you can do. It was never my intention to stay there for a lifetime, but to come back to this continent and see what I could do.
You write that at the monastery where you were, novices were told to leave their past behind and to become unexceptional in all ways, except for the intention to comprehend their Zen koans. Mm-hmm. Were you enthusiastic about the idea of trying to be unexceptional? I mean, let's face it, as a writer, I think one always tries to be exceptional, to find the right word, to have a poem be exceptionally good.
It was a marvelous training for me to be put somewhere where I was not to be exceptional. I recommend it highly. It's a wonderfully humbling experience. And as a writer, in a certain sense, as a poet, in a certain sense, I would not want to be exceptional. I would like my idea of a truly accomplished poetry is one that does not call attention to itself. Which is part of the Far Eastern aesthetic, actually.
Was writing poetry compatible with Zen studies? Did your Zen teacher approve of your writing poems?
He tormented me. he said, I could write poetry if it came from my true self. But who knows what your true self is? And then he twitted me by saying, poets have to play a lot. And so I thought, maybe I should quit writing poetry, because I certainly wasn't playing. Later one time I said to him, Roshi, so Zen is serious, but poetry is not serious. And he said, no, poetry is serious. Zen is not serious. He had a lot of fun with me.
So when you left, was it because you felt ready to leave or because your teacher felt you were ready to leave?
Well, my teacher died.
Oh.
After he died, I spent a couple of years living in Kyoto and studying other schools of Buddhism and visiting other temples and other monasteries and reflecting on what I had done with my teacher for those 6 years. I had then to make the choice between starting again over there with another teacher or coming back to this country. And just at that time, the beginning of the new round of ecological awareness was trembling on the horizon, and I could feel it. And the truth is, I came back in part because I wanted to be part of that.
So much of Zen teaching is about paradox, and you give a great example in your new book that your teacher would lecture you on the phrase, the perfect way is without difficulty, strive hard. I'm sure in environmentalism that there's a lot of paradoxes that you have to deal with now. I'm wondering what some of those might be. I mean, I'm wondering if you see paradox and accept it where others might not accept it.
Well, there are several paradoxes. Yeah, I hadn't thought about this before, but now that you bring it up, there are several that I've been aware of over the last few years. And one is that dedicated environmental activists, people who are really concerned to try to stop the loss of biological diversity, the loss of habitat, and the loss of good air and good water on the planet, who are lovers of wildness, are, if they are going to be effective, they are forced to understand the details of bureaucracy, economics, politics, and be willing to spend long hours working on computers, long hours on the phone, or even go and live in Washington, D.C. Now, there's a paradox for you.
If I'm not mistaken, during the McCarthy era, when you were working for the National Forest Service for a while, you were blacklisted or something? You had to leave?
I was fired.
You were fired?
I was fired on orders from Washington, D.C.
What exactly had you done or thought politically that that got you fired?
I think it was probably because I got my Siemens papers when I was 18 in New York City through the intercession of some officials in the Marine Cooks and Stewards Union, which was considered at that time a party, a Communist Party-dominated union. And because friends of mine arranged that for me, they assumed that I was Communist Party or very close to Communist Party. I certainly had many friends who were in the far left there, but my own position had always been that of a cantankerous anarchist, in fact. Nonetheless, you know, that stuck on my record for some years.
Do you think of yourself as a cantankerous anarchist now?
Oh, sure.
And what does that mean?
That means I'm very dubious about the virtue or the legitimacy of the national state as an institution, and I do believe that human beings are and can be self-governing in smaller social units, and that for the most part, what we call a national government is a giant protection racket, just like the mafia runs.
What kind of relationship do you have with the people who live near you politically and socially? I don't mean, you know, like going over for a cup of tea or something, but in terms of the environmental interests that you care most about and the things that you need to do to preserve the wildness around you.
We all work together. It is an error to think that people who live in rural areas have an easy time of it and can lay back and groove with nature and that there's no politics. The politics of public lands, of resource extraction, mining, in this case, water politics, and the pressures of rapid real estate development and growth are all around us. And we have meetings two or three nights a week.
Do anarchists like yourself like going to meetings three times a week?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I find no contradiction in that.
You don't?
I mean, anarchism simply means self-governing. And self-governing means you've got to get out there and learn how to do it.
Your new book is a collection of essays that you've been working on for a long time. Are you still writing poems?
Oh, yeah, I've been writing a lot of poems over the last few years.
Any that are short and that you remember? Because I know you probably don't have any recent ones with you, but is there any short poem you'd like to leave us with?
I'd like to leave you with this, which is a little turn on forests and the idea of ecological climax. A virgin forest is ancient, many breasted, stable at climax.
Gary Snyder, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Gary Snyder's new book is The Practice of the Wild, and there's a new edition of his collection, Rip Rap and Cold Mountain Poems. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eviscerated corpses, amputated limbs, and moving walls used to be the images in Patrick McGraw's stories, but now he relies more on psychological torment to quicken the pulse of his readers. Coming up, Patrick McGraw talks about his new gothic fiction and reads from his new novel, Spider. And Tom Selleck, Steve Guttenberg, and Ted Danson have reunited for the sequel to Three Men and a Baby. Film critic Owen Gleiberman has a review of Three Men and a Little Lady. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Army says it has taken steps to keep officers and enlisted personnel in uniform to ensure that there are enough troops to provide reinforcement for U.S. forces in the Persian Gulf. NPR's Vicki O'Hara reports.
Army personnel who had planned to retire or leave the service at the end of their enlistments will have to wait, by order of Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. The Army says it also is freezing all transfers of soldiers from overseas to bases stateside, and that it's canceling the two-week Christmas break for all training centers and military schools. The Marine Corps also is trying to protect its troop strength. It announced today that it may keep up to 12,000 regular and reserve Marines from leaving the service. President Bush gave Defense Secretary Cheney the authority to keep people on duty in the Gulf past their retirement or reenlistment dates. In Washington, this is Vicki O'Hara.
The president has left Switzerland and is on his way home to Washington. He spent about 3 hours in Geneva today talking about the Persian Gulf situation with Syrian President Assad. Mr. Bush was wrapping up an 8-day trip to Europe and the Middle East. He's tried to solidify the coalition opposing Iraq in the Persian Gulf. Secretary of State Baker is continuing his effort to win support for a UN Security Council resolution that authorizes the use of force against Iraq. George Guetta reports from the State Department.
Baker has met with officials of 9 council members thus far on his foreign tour, and 2 more are scheduled for tomorrow. After an all-night flight from Saudi Arabia, Baker has a morning meeting with officials from Colombia. Then it's on to Los Angeles for talks with officials from Malaysia. Baker wants a resolution on military force because the resolutions the council has approved thus far have had no visible impact on President Saddam Hussein. Baker also contends that a lopsided vote in favor of his proposed resolution will convince the Iraqis they have limited international backing. At a meeting today, the foreign ministers of China and the Soviet Union, both Security Council members, discussed the Persian Gulf but did not make recommendations on future steps for resolving the crisis. For National Public Radio, I'm George Guetta at the State Department.
The Soviet National Legislature asked the Kremlin today to quickly sign temporary agreements with the 15 Soviet republics to prevent the further breakup of the country. The Supreme Soviet, the legislature, is bogged down in negotiating a new union treaty, but the country's republics are growing increasingly restive and are disregarding Kremlin authority. The agreements could also help stabilize the economic situation. The Treasury Department has announced today the United States has posted a budget deficit of $31,460,000,000 for October, the opening month of the 1991 fiscal year. The department says the deficit follows a surplus in September that totaled $20,840,000,000. Stock prices fell moderately on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones closed down 12.13 points at 2527.
This is Fresh Air. For those of us who are drawn to tales of madness, violence, and perversity, there's a substantial tradition of Gothic fiction. Poe, Kafka, and Mary Shelley all contributed to the imagery and drama of the Gothic form. Patrick McGraw is a writer who's updating the genre. He's the author of a collection of short stories, Blood, Water, and Other Tales, and a novel, The Grotesque. He's also editing an anthology of new Gothic fiction. McGraw has a new novel, Spider, and in a few minutes he'll read us an excerpt from it. I was struck when reading Spider by how McGraw's writing has changed, moving away from the bizarre and supernatural to the psychological.
I think that's very true. Spider is very much a portrait of a schizophrenic, and whatever elements of the macabre, the perverse, the grotesque that are contained within that book are very much a function of a psychotic mind breaking down rather than, in any sense, pieces of gratuitous horror for their own sake.
Why is your fiction moving in that direction?
I think because the Gothic genre that I've been fascinated and delighted with for a number of years now is beginning to show me just what it's capable of in terms of handling extreme psychological states. And I'm growing more interested in what it can do in terms of depiction of extreme psychological states than I am in simply, filling a story with as many sort of dark and nasty images as I can come up with.
Let me ask you for your comparison of Gothic versus New Gothic fiction.
Well, I think the traditional Gothic did lay a lot of stress on the furniture, on the dripping caves and the mouldering mansions on the top of hills and dark forests. There's a great stress on the props and the sets. We no longer need those props and sets in order to depict the sorts of characters that inhabited those sorts of locations, and now we can simply depict the mind itself, and it doesn't have to be accompanied by clanking chains and gloomy fortresses and so on. So I think the Gothic is now much more exclusively a psychological condition.
So your fiction is in a way kind of following the changes that have happened in the form.
Yeah, many of the stories in Blood and Water were very much pastiches of the form in which I played with certain standard Gothic elements like severed hands or vampires or bad priests and so on. And at that point, I was really just taking a delight in the Gothic and its excesses. And as I said, now I'm much more interested in the implications of working that sort of terrain, that sort of, you know, that dark side of normality and reason and order and so on. And that is giving me more and more insight into the ways of handling madness and perversity within fiction.
You joined us a couple of years ago on Fresh Air when your collection of short stories was published. Mm. And our listeners might remember that you grew up near the gate of an institution for the criminally insane in London, and your father was the medical superintendent there. How does that figure specifically into your new novel, Spider?
Well, I, as a result of growing up the son of my father, I was equipped with a fairly thorough grounding in mental illness as a small boy. I later worked in his hospital and in another hospital in Canada, and so I got to know at first hand what schizophrenia looks like and other forms of mental illness. When I came to write fiction, I found that this formed a sort of a reservoir of knowledge that I more and more have been able to draw on, which has culminated in this latest novel, which is really centrally a depiction of schizophrenia from a first-hand account of schizophrenia.
I believe your father is retired, but did you show him the manuscript, and did he give you any advice?
Yeah, I would show him the manuscript in various early drafts, and he was very quick to tell me what was plausible and what was not in what I was depicting as, you know, as a schizophrenic condition. In fact, when I wanted to actually have a relatively a gentle ending to the novel, he told me that this, in fact, was not plausible, that the schizophrenic's fate is generally a rather grim one. So he did push me in the direction of you know, not shying away from the full sort of ghastly horror that schizophrenia is.
What are the considerations when you're writing a book and the narrator is mentally unbalanced, like in your book?
This was the great technical challenge here, was to contain the incoherence and the wildness of madness within the order and the continuity that the novel form demands. And I don't know if I can quite put my finger on how I solved that problem, but a lot of it has to do with, I think, using different time frames. And Spider is always in... he is referring back to his childhood, he's referring to the present, and he's also referring to his period in mental hospital. So there's three times that occurring simultaneously within the novel, and I found that if I moved between these three times, I could, when Spider began to sort of drift off into the more wild areas of his illness, I could bring us back by moving to a different, you know, he would perhaps begin to talk about the present and what he was experiencing in the present as a way of reining us in and giving us once more the sense of where the narrative's going.
When a narrator is schizophrenic, like the character who narrates your novel, the reader really doesn't know how much to trust him.
No, not at all. So the reader has to almost read a second text beyond the one that's in front of him. You have to, in some way, second-guess Spider and understand by what principle he is constantly distorting what it is that he's reporting to you. And once you catch that principle, then you can begin to really interpret what he's telling. You say, no, I know this is not true, but I understand that when he says this, what he means is this, because I've begun to see, you know, the ways in which he contradicts himself and the sorts of anomalies there are in his account.
In just a few moments, you're going to read to us from your new novel, Spider. Is there anything you'd like to say to prepare us for the reading?
Just to remember that by the time you've got to that point in the book, you may well have begun to suspect that Spider's account of things may be somewhat flawed, and to perhaps be alert to that as you hear him describe himself and his father and his mother. Just be alert to the those points at which perhaps he protesteth too much.
Okay, Patrick, thanks very much. And stay with us, because Patrick McGraw is going to read from his new novel, Spider, after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Here's Patrick McGraw to introduce his reading from his new novel, Spider.
Our narrator in this passage is a strange, sad, solitary figure called Spider. Now, after an absence of 20 years, Spider returns to the slums of the East End of London, where he grew up, and moves into a seedy boarding house run by the indomitable Mrs. Wilkinson. In this passage, he'll recall memories of his father, Horace, a plumber, and of his long-suffering mother. I haven't even told you my name yet. It's Dennis, but my mother always called me Spider. I am a baggy, threadbare sort of a customer, really. My clothes have always seemed to flap about me like sailcloth, like sheets and shrouds. I catch a glimpse of them sometimes as I hobble through these empty streets, and they always look vacant, untenanted, the way the flannel flaps and hollows about me, as though I were nothing, and the clothes were clinging merely to an idea of a man, the man himself being elsewhere, naked. These feelings disappear when I reach my bench, for there I am anchored. I have a wall behind me and water in front of me, and as long as I don't look at the gasworks, all is well. But I had a bit of a shock yesterday, for I discovered that nothing fit me any more. I noticed it first when I got up from the bench. My trousers barely reached the tops of my ankles, and from the ends of my sleeves, my wrists were poking out to an absurd length, like sticks, before flowering suddenly into these long, floppy hands of mine. When I arrived back at the house, everything seemed to have returned to normal, and it occurred to me that the problem might be with my body rather than my clothes. Of course, I wouldn't think of speaking to Mrs. Wilkinson about any of this. She has already made her views clear on the subject. She has forbidden me to wear more than one of any article of clothing at any one time, no more than one pair of trousers, one shirt, one jersey, and so on, though naturally I defy her on this, as I like to wear as many of my clothes as I can. I find it reassuring, and since returning from Canada, reassurance is something I'm simply not getting enough of. Probably the whole thing was just some sort of perceptual error. I have occasionally been troubled this way in the past. I'm a much taller man than my father was, but in other respects I resemble him. He was wiry and short-sighted. He wore round, horn-rimmed spectacles that made him appear owlish. His eyes had a deceptively mild, watery sort of look to them, and when he took his spectacles off, you realised what a startlingly pale blue colour they were. But I've seen those eyes of his fire up with anger, and when that happened, there was nothing mild and watery about him at all, and as often as not, I'd be taken down the coal cellar and feel the back of his belt. Not that he'd let anyone else ever see his anger. He was much too careful for that. But my mother and myself, we saw it. He had no other outlet for it. We were the only people in the world weaker than he was. I remember my mother used to say, "Run down the dog, Spider, and tell your father his supper's on the table." And that's when I knew I'd see that furious pale light come up. The dog was the pub on the corner of Kitchener Street, the Dog and Beggar. It was not a big pub. There were four rooms, the public bar, the saloon bar, and two small snugs where private conversation could be had, each room separated from the others by a wooden screen inset with panels of frosted glass. My father drank in the public bar, and I can still recall pushing open the door and being immediately assailed by a welter of sounds and smells, men's talk, their barks of laughter, thick smoke, beer, sawdust on the bare boards, and in the winter, a small coal fire burning in the grate. Above the mantelpiece, I remember, was a mirror with a black toucan on it, and the words, "Guinness is good for you." I couldn't read the first word. I only knew that something was good for you. There wasn't anything good for me in the public bar of the Dog and Beggar. I'd see him at the bar, his back bent, leaning with his elbows on the counter and one boot up on the brass rail that ran the length of it at ankle height. Someone would say, "Here's Horace's boy," or "Here's your boy, Horace," and I'd see him turn toward me, a cigarette hanging from his lips, and in his eyes there'd be only that cold loathing that came of being reminded again of the fact of his family and the house to which he must return from the careless sanctuary of the public bar. I'd blurt out my message, my little voice piping like a tin whistle among those shuffling, grunting men, those cattle at their beer. And he would tell me to go on back to the house. He'd be along shortly. No one would know, only I, how intense, how venomous was the hatred he felt toward me at that moment, and I'd hurry away as quick as I could. I was never able to tell my mother how much I disliked going into the Dog and delivering her message, for my father disguised his feelings so effectively, she would have laughed to hear me explain what was really going on. When he was in this frame of mind, and drinking only made things worse, drinking broke down his reserve, mealtimes were hell. I would sit at the kitchen table, gazing at the ceiling, where an unshaded bulb dangled on the end of a braided brown cord. I tended always to slip into reverie in that poky little kitchen, with its clanging pots and dripping tap and ever-present smell of boiling cabbage. It made those ghastly meals tolerable. Outside, the twilight darkened into night, and from over by the railway embankment came the scream of a whistle as some suburban train went steaming by. My mother put in front of me a plate of boiled potatoes, boiled cabbage, and stewed neck of mutton, the meat coming away from the bone in stringy greyish patches. There was a terrible tension in the room as I picked up my knife and fork. I knew my father was watching me. And this made things worse, for I was a clumsy boy at the best of times, only poorly in control of those long, gangling limbs of mine. I stuffed a large lump of potato in my mouth, but it was too hot, so I had to cough it back onto my plate. "For Christ's sake," he hissed between clenched teeth. My mother glanced at him, her own fork poised over a potato that sat like a plug in a greasy puddle of thin gravy. "Don't lose your temper," she murmured. "It's not the boy's fault." The meal progressed in painful silence. There were no further train noises from over by the railway embankment, nor was there anything moving on Kitchener Street. Cutlery clattered on cheap china as we ate our neck of mutton, and the tap dripped into the sink with a steady plop, plop, plop. The bulb overhead continued to spread a sickly yellow light over the room, and having devoured my food, I sat once more gazing at the ceiling with my lips faintly moving, pausing only to pick at a shred of mutton caught between my teeth. "Put the kettle on then, Spider," said my mother, and I rose to my feet. As I did so, I banged one of my kneecaps against the side of the table, jarring it violently, such that my father's plate moved several inches to the left. I felt him stiffen then. I felt his grip tighten on his fork, onto the end of which he had just scraped a soggy pile of pale, limp cabbage. But mercifully, he said nothing. I lit the gas. At last he finished eating, laid his knife and fork across the middle of his plate, placed his hands on the edge of the table, elbows arched outward at a sharp angle, and prepared to get up from the table. "Off down the pub, I suppose," said my mother, still at work on her last potato, which she had cut into a number of very small pieces, and without lifting her eyes to my father's face. I cast a quick, fearful glance at him. And in the way his jaw worked, I knew what he thought of the pair of us, his gangling, useless son and his mutely reproachful wife, who sat there making little pokes and stabs at her potato and refusing to meet his eye. He took his cap and jacket from the hook on the back of the door and went out without a word. The kettle came to the boil. "Make us a nice cup of tea then, Spider," said my mother, rising from her chair and brushing at her cheek as she began to gather the dirty plates.
Patrick McGraw, reading from his new novel, Spider. It's published by Poseidon Press. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, it's Noah Adams with a word about All Things Considered coming up soon from National Public Radio in Washington. We'll have a report from Tom Jelton in Poland on the upcoming elections there. Poland will choose a new president, and Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa is campaigning hard in a controversial effort. I'll talk with the leader of the Labour Party, the opposition in Britain, about how they see the election shaping up for 1992, now that the Conservative Party leader and Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, has resigned. Gary Covino reports from Chicago on quite an intense poetry competition there. And Bob Mondello has reviewed the new film starring Joanne Woodward and Paul Newman. It's called Mr. and Mrs. Bridge. That's coming up soon on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
Three Men and a Baby was the top-grossing movie of 1987, and now the inevitable sequel has arrived. Film critic Owen Glaberman takes a look at Three Men and a Little Lady.
Three Men and a Baby was the blandest blockbuster of the 80s. Seeing Tom Selleck, Ted Danson, and Steve Guttenberg together in one movie was a little like sitting down to a course of mixed vegetables comprised of three varieties of squash. Then again, the collective flavorlessness of the three stars probably helped make the movie a hit. Without any major comic talent to get in the way, this story of three swinging bachelors learning to change diapers and become caring daddies could play as a soothing fantasy of domesticated macho. Selleck, Danson, and Guttenberg were perfectly likable. They just weren't very funny, and I was pretty much dreading the sequel. But Three Men and a Little Lady turns out to be a very pleasant comedy. Baby Mary has grown up into an adorable five-year-old, and her actress mother, played by Nancy Travis, is now part of the household. At first, the filmmaker seems stuck for a gimmick. Trying to diffuse the fact that the one mommy and three daddies arrangement seems, well, a bit kinky, they indulge in much earnest dialogue about the character's needs. For a while, the movie plays like an unholy cross between Three's Company and 30-something.
If Mary and I hadn't moved in here and taken up your lives like this, you'd be in very different places by now.
We'd be married.
We'd be divorced. You've saved us a fortune.
You can joke all you want. But the bottom line is Mary needs a more normal environment. She is very confused right now, and to be honest, so am I.
All right. Okay. I'll live up to my responsibility. You want to marry me?
Jack, be serious.
I am being serious. We had a child together, for goodness sake. What do you say? Want to sleep on it?
She did that once before, Jack.
Hey, shut up.
Fortunately, all of this hand-wringing turns out to be an elaborate setup. Selleck, you see, has gone and fallen in love with Travis. The trouble is, he's too darn shy to admit it. When she scampers off to England with her director, taking Mary along, our three heroes follow, and the movie turns into an enjoyably broad clash of cultures farce. There's nothing much you haven't seen before. Selleck drives on the wrong side of the road, and the British characters are a collection of over-civilized lunatics. But director Emile Ardolino, who made Dirty Dancing, stages the routines with a likable zest. The gifted British actress Fiona Shaw has a small comic triumph, playing a frumpy boarding school proprietress who keeps lusting after Selleck.
Did I frighten you?
I was expecting Mary, that's all.
Ah, little Mary, yes. What a delightful, if somewhat willful child. She'll make an excellent Pile 4 student.
She's going to your school?
Well, not immediately. No. But eventually.
I'm sorry, but she wouldn't like it.
What makes you say that?
Well, I just know, that's all. Boarding school is definitely not for her.
Tell me, are you always such a slave to your instincts?
Shaw, who played Daniel Day-Lewis's teacher in My Left Foot, keeps building up to her twittery $10 words as though they were incredibly erotic. It's performances like hers that help give the movie some comic style. What's more, there's something about playing Daddy that liberates Selleck. For once, he shakes the wood out of his acting. I don't want to overpraise Three Men and a Little Lady. It's obviously pure fluff. But it's also a much funnier movie than its predecessor.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers, with production assistance from Joan Tuohy, Roberta Shurrock, and Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Reverend Theodore Hesburgh was the president of Notre Dame University for 35 years. On the next Fresh Air, he tells us why he thinks he was one of the few presidents who outlasted the student protests of the 60s. Also, British actress Billie Whitelaw on her new movie The Craze and her work with the late Samuel Beckett. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.